Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Friday, House Democrats rejected President Obama's secretive free trade deal. The 302 to 126 vote came right after President Obama went to Capitol Hill to persuade Democrats to vote yes on the Trade Adjustment Assistance Bill. The TAA is designed to help workers who lose their jobs because of trade deals. Public sector union members would not be covered. Now, the TAA vote was important because it would have paved the way for passage of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. Now, although Fast Track did pass, it stalled because the House failed to pass the TAA. Now, opponents have been flooding politicians with phone calls over the past month, and they credit a diverse coalition for the temporary defeat of the TPP. 2,000 groups have joined forces in opposition, including the ACLU, Consumers Union, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Friends of the Earth, and the NAACP. Labor groups also played a pivotal role in defeating President Obama and his corporate allies that spent over $160 million to lobby Congress on this issue. Thea Lee, an AFL-CIO trade expert, told The Guardian, quote, "The Obama administration concluded that they could win with Republican votes and could blow off their Democratic base. That strategy blew up in their face," end quote. So how will popular opposition to President Obama's signature trade policy determine the future of the TPP? And now that WikiLeaks has released sections of the TPP, what do we know about its long-term effects on the economy and labor rights? Joining us to talk about the recent House vote and the future of the TPP is Dean Baker, macroeconomist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Dean joins us from Washington. Hi, Dean. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Great to have you. And David Dayan is contributing writer for Salon, and he joins us from Los Angeles. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks.
Great to have you. So David, let's start off with you. There's a little bit of confusion about the TAA and the TPP. First off, what is the Trade Adjustment Assistance? Those of us who've been following the TPP have been reading about the TAA just for the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think they almost make it deliberately confusing by making the acronyms as close to one another as possible. So the issue is that this bill would not get through a Senate filibuster and clear with a number of Democrats supporting if there wasn't something to compensate for the expected loss of jobs that inevitably result from trade deals. So this TAA, Trade Adjustment Assistance, which has been around since the 1960s, was sort of devised as a sweetener to go along with this Fast Track policy. And in Fast Track, the president gets the authority, which is constitutionally Congress's authority, to negotiate trade agreements and then bring them back for a guaranteed up or down vote without a filibuster, without the possibility for amendment, and a guaranteed vote on the legislative calendar. So the TAA is then used as a sweetener to get Democrats aboard. They can go back and say, well, at least we got something for the workers who are going to be displaced by the trade agreements that will result from Fast Track. So these are almost always paired. Fast Track votes and TAA are almost always put together. One side votes to the part of the bill they like, the other side votes to the part of the bill they like, and the policy itself moves forward.
Okay.
But
how much teeth does the TAA really have when it comes to helping workers who lose their jobs because of trade deals? I mean, what about the workers who lost their jobs because of NAFTA?
Yeah. TAA is some studies have shown it to be fairly ineffective. It provides worker retraining, it provides some premium support for health insurance, it provides a couple other things. But typically, and a study by the Wilson Quarterly has shown that workers who apply for trade adjustment assistance end up getting jobs that pay 30% less than they did prior to having a job. So what Democrats really figured out is that even though they can go back to their constituents and say, well, we got something to offset this loss a bit, they realize that they don't have to play this game, that if Republicans don't want to pass trade adjustment assistance because they think it's welfare or whatever, then if Democrats withhold their support, they can bring down this entire trade agenda. And that's really what was done on Friday in the House.
Well, and also your headline says it all, David. The Democrats' TPP rebellion just drew blood. Everything you need to know about today's shocking vote. You wrote this on Friday. How surprising was this vote? Again, it was 302 to 126.
It was fairly surprising that Democrats who are opposed to the kind of trade deals that result from the fast-track process actually used, made a strategic vote, actually used the power, the leverage that was given to them by the fact that Republicans would not support trade adjustment assistance and that these votes were linked together so that both of them had to pass in order for this bill to move forward. And that's something that's a little bit rare. Democrats don't typically, when President Obama went up to the Hill, he asked the Democratic caucus to, quote unquote, play it straight on this bill. In other words, vote for the thing you like and let this all move forward. But they realized that it would probably be better for less people to lose their jobs from trade deals than to compensate the few with a few bucks, kind of like a throwing money in a tip jar to someone that's lost their house. It's better to just stop the job loss to begin with. So that's what Democrats figured out. That was the decision that they made, and it was fairly surprising.
And Dean, what are your thoughts on that? Because President Obama went to the House that morning to try to persuade Democrats to vote for the bill. A lot of reports said that Nancy Pelosi, behind the scenes, was giving cover to Democrats who were going to vote yes. But, I mean, her office was flooded with phone calls. I called just to see how they would respond. And right when I mentioned TPP, they cut me off and threw me to voicemail without even saying, please hold. I mean, they were completely bombarded with phone calls.
Yeah, trade is clearly not popular. I mean, I've been in D.C. since the NAFTA debate, and, it's the same story each time. The public really dislikes the trade deals with good cause. You have a lot of people lose their jobs, and it puts downward pressure on wages. So even more important than the specific individuals, I'm not belittling the individuals who lose their jobs. Of course, it's horrible for them, but it's a much, much larger impact. It's been a big factor in the downward pressure on wages for large segments of the population. We used to say this back in the 90s, and a lot of the economists poo-pooed that. A lot of the mainstream economists poo-pooed that. Now you have people like David Autor at MIT, who's a very well-respected labor economist. He's done some of the best research on this, and he says, yes, trade has had a downward impact, a negative impact on the wages of large segments of the workforce. So, I'm not going to say everyone, all economists agree with that, but that's now a very respected, accepted position in the profession. So, having the trade adjustment assistance, that's nice, but that's really kind of, as David put it, I think that's a good characterization, throwing money in the tip jar for someone who lost their house. Mm. It's really not in the ballpark. But anyhow, they have all the... They're sitting there, President Obama and Speaker Boehner, they're basically sitting there holding all the chips. They're going around telling everyone, look, you support us on this. We're going to campaign for you. We'll get you campaign contributions. Do you need something for your district? We joked about how when President Clinton was trying to round up the last votes for NAFTA, that we were calling it bridges for NAFTA. You need a bridge in your district? My favorite is there's now the J.J. Pickles Center of International Trade that's affiliated with one of the universities in Texas, because J.J. Pickle was holding out on his vote. Well, they got his vote. They created a Center for International Trade named after him. So you get ridiculous things like that because they're sitting there with all the money. And that's why it was so impressive that, the Democrats ended up not buckling. They were getting the phone calls. Nancy Pelosi was not the only one. It's good to hear she got so many. But, she all across the country, people were calling their members of Congress, calling their Republicans, too, of course, and saying, we're against this deal. And, many of them said, hey, we're up for election next year. We're not going to go for it.
What are your thoughts about the politics behind this? Because the Prospect magazine's Robert Kuttner had a piece in the Washington Post, and he writes, quote, "The real story here is a deep and principled split between the congressional wing of the Democratic Party, most of whose members are still fairly progressive, and a presidential wing that has been in bed with Wall Street at least since Bill Clinton and Bob Rubin." He goes on to say House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi has loyally backed President Obama despite White House missteps on financial reform, going against the wishes of her closest allies. Pelosi gamely tried to bridge differences between Obama and the Democratic caucus on the deal until it was clear the differences were just not bridgeable. Only then did she decide with a large majority of her colleagues. Dean, what are your thoughts on the politics behind this?
Well, I think that's largely right. I mean, this is very much a business deal. You know, you just go, and all this is kind of in front of our face, so it's not like I'm conspiracy theory. You know, this deal was negotiated in secret by working groups. The overwhelming majority of the people in the working groups are from major corporations. So they sit down with the telecommunications industry. They have, you know, I don't know the exact number, 4, 5, 6 representatives, all from, you know, Verizon and the other big companies. And they say, what do you want in a trade deal? They go to aerospace. What do you want, you know, Boeing? What do you want in a trade deal? They go to the entertainment industry. What do you want in a trade deal? You know, the pharmaceutical industry. What do you want in a trade deal? So you hand these major industry groups basically writing a trade deal to advance their interest. Now it's time to get that through. And Obama's worried, looking really foolish to these people. He said, you know, tell us what you want, we'll get it for you. And now it looks like, you know, they say, oh, after so much effort was put into it, and I go, well, were you working on it? You know, well, they put a lot of work into it. Business people put a lot of work into it. And now, you know, it looks like that might go for nothing if, you know, President Obama at the end of the day can't get the trade deal approved.
And Dean, what is your read on why President Obama is pushing so hard for the TPP?
Well, I think it really is about getting business support for the Democrats. So, you know, they obviously, you know, you have support for labor from, you know, the African-American community, Hispanic community, but they need money for their campaigns. So I think it's, you know, that's a little crass, but, you know, oftentimes the simplest explanation, the crassest explanation fits the bill. So he's looking to, you know, show, hey, we could deliver for business. The Republicans don't have to prove that because, you know, they're always pushing through tax cuts and pro-business regulation. But, you know, the Democrats hang out with, you know, people like David and I. So, you know, they're questionable. So they have to show, hey, we're going to get you, you know, a pro-business trade deal. And then you give money for our people running for Congress and Senate next year. And, of course, you know, for the presidential campaign.
And David, what are your thoughts on that based on the people you've interviewed? How do they explain President Obama's push for the TPP?
I think that's part of it. I also think that there's sort of a mind share that happens in Washington that when the only people that have your ear are CEOs of major corporations and not people at an engine plant in Darlington, Wisconsin that just lost their job because the factory was outsourced to Mexico, then you get a very distorted view of the benefits of international trade. Of course, the main office that negotiates these trade deals is called the U.S. Trade Representative's Office. And the Center for Responsive Politics has shown that 144 former employees of the U.S. Trade Representative's Office went on to work as corporate lobbyists. Mm. In fact, Representative Alan Grayson told me for a story for the American Prospect that there are only three types of people that work at the U.S. Trade Rep's Office. People who were lobbyists, people who want to be lobbyists, and people who were lobbyists and want to be lobbyists again. And that's generally the case. And so when the president delegates sort of within his White House the authority to negotiate trade deals, he's delegating it to a group that is just sort of a way station for multinational corporations, like the White Shoe Law Firm for multinational corporations. So you get the result that you expect from that.
And before we talk about the specifics of the trade deal, WikiLeaks is offering money for leaks, and they've had quite a few leaks so far. So we talked about the TAA, the Trade Adjustment Assistance, which went down on Friday, 302 to 126. Again, in order for the TPP to move forward, the TAA must pass. Now, also on Friday, Fast Track did pass. Dean, is that significant?
It's somewhat significant. I mean, you did get a majority of members to say they were for Fast Track. Now, everyone voted in that understanding that you had to pass three bills in order to have something comparable to the Senate bill. This is one of these things, you know, it's Washington kind of insider rulemaking and this and that. But basically, to get into conference, you had the Senate pass a bill that included basically three separate bills before the House. You don't get to conference unless you pass pretty much those three bills. So people voted for Fast Track, that was indicating their support for it. On the other hand, they knew they would have the opportunity to stop it by voting against one of the other two bills. And the vast majority of people voted against at least one, and obviously most of them voted against the trade adjustment assistance, which was what ultimately killed it. So, you know, I take it the votes for the Fast Track itself, you know, is indicating that you have a lot of people saying that, well, we're not set against it. You know, if you want to be crude, that, you know, our vote could still be swung, you know, come talk to us, you know. But clearly they understood that it doesn't go through unless all three votes pass.
So where is it now? Because the New York Times is reporting that yesterday Republican leaders and White House officials are looking at ways to resurrect the legislation. The New York Times reports that in meetings at the Capitol and in phone conversations with President Obama and administration officials, lawmakers ticked through a list of complicated procedural options that could circumvent House Democratic opposition to granting the president the power to expedite trade deals. So, David, where does this the TPP stand now in light of what the New York Times is reporting?
Yeah, they don't have a lot of good options. There was a claim that there was going to be a vote this week, a revote on TAA to see if they could persuade enough Democrats to pass. That's not going to happen. What House Speaker Boehner has done is he's trying to extend the ability for that revote to occur. Basically, within a completely unrelated bill, an intelligence authorization bill, he's put in this extension so that technically he could bring up the vote for TAA anytime between now and July 30th. And if that ever passed, then that could go immediately to the president because Fast Track has already passed. All they actually need is for TAA to pass, and then that could go to the president for a signature. However, getting there is a very tall order, and whether you extend it to July 30th or not, there's no real change in the impasse here. Democrats certainly see that this is their only leverage to stop the bill, and Republicans are wary of voting for TAA, mainly because the Club for Growth, which is an organization that contributes to the primaries of Republican House members, has said this is a key vote, that if you vote for TAA, we're going to come after you. And so that's the problem on the Republican side, and the problem on the Democratic side is that they don't want to see Fast Track pass. I don't see how you square that circle. And if Republicans in the House decide, okay, well, we'll just pass a new bill that's just Fast Track and throw it to the Senate and see what they can do with it, the problem is that senators on the Democratic side who provided the margin of victory for the Fast Track bill in the Senate have already said that without TAA, they won't vote for it. So I just don't see how this gets done between now and July 30th, and that's really kind of a deadline because after that point, we get towards the presidential season, and as Trent Lott said, you only pass trade deals in you know, odd-numbered years. They never pass an even number of years when citizens are actually paying attention.
Yeah, just to pick on that point, what David was saying about the deadline, we don't have a completed deal right now. So the sequence has to be that Congress would pass Fast Track. Then you would get the final rounds of negotiations between the United States and the other countries in the TPP, which, you know, take an optimistic scenario from their vantage point, it's got to take at least a month, probably a month and a half. And then after that, it's got to take at least 60 days to drop on Congress. So that's why it's very much getting into the election season. And, you know, as David said, they don't pass trade deals in even number of years.
Dean Baker is a macroeconomist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, and David Dayan is a contributing writer for Salon. You can find their work at yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade deal that involves Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam, and the U.S., of course. President Obama is pushing really hard for the TPP. On Friday, he went to the House to try to persuade Democrats to vote for it. So the TAA was on the table. Again, that's the Trade Adjustment Assistance Bill, which is designed to help workers who lose their jobs. But a lot of people say that it really doesn't have much teeth. The TAA went down 302 to 126. In order for the TPP to move forward, the TAA must pass. Now, if you have any questions about the TPP, what's in this secretive deal, we'd love to hear from you. We are getting a lot of leaks from WikiLeaks and others, and we'll talk about that. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you work with an organization that is working on the TPP, we'd love to hear from you. There's a massive coalition that's working against this, environmental groups, civil rights groups, women's groups. Why do you think President Obama is spending so much political capital on getting fast-track authority? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And reading just a couple emails, Greg writes, why does Obama think we can't see the TPP? Why does he lecture us like we're children? Are we really ignorant people like he thinks? Maybe Clinton is the new Messiah. We all thought Obama was. What do you think? Armand writes, kill it, shoot it with a silver bullet, bury it, and hope it never rises from the dead again. Jane writes in, it's already known that this bill will put Americans out of work. Why would any American politician even consider talking about it, let alone passing it? And then we have a email from Carol who says, a New York Times article made the point that the TPP is also a political maneuver. The list of countries involved in the TPP pointedly exclude China. The TPP is seen as a bulwark against China's power. If China were to join, they would have to play by the rules other countries are bound by, such as floating their currency, which would make their goods more expensive. If China does not join, the U.S. will be seen as being on the side of the Asian countries who fear China's influence. Dean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, you know, that is one of the big issues. One of the main reasons that certainly Labor and many others object to this deal is that it doesn't have anything on floating currencies. One of the main reasons, well, I shouldn't say one, the main reason that the United States has a $500 billion annual trade deficit is because the dollar is propped up against the currencies of China and many other countries. And, you know, people have raised this, you know, why aren't we pressuring these countries to stop propping up the dollar? It has the same effect. If the dollar is overvalued by 20% against the Chinese currency, it's the same effect as if China were to impose a 20% tariff on all imports from the United States and have a 20% subsidy on all exports. It's 180 degrees of odds of free trade. So people care about free trade should care very much about currency manipulation or management, whatever term you want to use. And there is clearly no provision. We haven't seen the document, but the administration has made clear currency is not on the table with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has, you know, Labor and many others kind of angry because you go, here you are putting together this big deal, and, you know, this is a great opportunity. They say, well, it doesn't have to be in a trade deal. You go, well, fine. When are you going to do anything about it? So it's basically just telling, you know, blowing off, you know, the unions and, of course, workers that, you know, we don't care about the trade deficit. And that's costing millions of jobs. It's a major reason that we're still way below full employment in the U.S., that the labor market's weak, that people can't get pay raises. And they just chose, you know, take a ride. They're not going to include currency in the deal, you know. And if you try and press them, they go, oh, the other countries didn't want it. You go, there's lots of things the other countries didn't want. You know, the United States says we want it, and they want to have access to our market, so they make concessions on it. But clearly currency was not on their list.
And Dean, just quickly before we go to break, what would you have liked to see in the bill on currency? What could the administration have done?
Well, they could have made rules saying that, you know, countries, the way China props up the dollar is they hold massive amounts. They have $4 trillion of reserves, not all of its dollars, most of its dollars. You could put limits on how much you have by way of foreign reserves. There's rules of thumb. Usually it's 6 months of imports. You could take, you know, other rules. But the point is you could sit down and negotiate rules on currency that would prevent the sort of management and overvaluation of the dollar that we've been seeing in recent years.
Dean Baker is macroeconomist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and David Dayan is contributing writer for Salon. Today on Your Call, we are talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. In order for it to move forward, the TAA, Trade Adjustment Assistance Bill, must pass, and it died in the House on Friday. So we're talking about the current status of the TPP, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, Ben James is your host for World Have Your Say. Among the stories, should the Pope be wading into the debate on climate change, or as some suggest, stick to theology and morality? Or is climate change part of that morality? Plus, does the Italy-France border row point to the beginning of the end for Europe's open borders? That's World Have Your Say, coming up in an hour.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about urban agriculture. 80% of the U.S. population lives in cities, further from farms than ever. But more and more city dwellers are growing their own food. The documentary Growing Cities looks at this trend from the Bay Area to Detroit. So we'll talk about how urban farms are revitalizing communities and changing the way we eat. And then on Thursday, we will talk about online privacy and how things have changed as so many people use apps for a number of things and give apps so much personal information. That is on Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is a massive, massive trade deal. Public Citizen calls it NAFTA on steroids, being pushed hard by President Obama and Republicans, some Democrats. President Obama went to the House on Friday to persuade Democrats to vote for the TAA, Trade Adjustment Assistance, which would help workers, or it's supposed to help workers, who lose their jobs because of trade deals. This was really important because in order for the TPP to move forward, the TAA must pass. And it went down by a 302 to 126 vote. So we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about this? Why is the president pushing the TPP so hard? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Dean Baker, macroeconomist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and David Dayan, contributing writer for Salon. We talked a little bit about currency. Before we talk more specifics, David, as a journalist, what has it been like for you to try to get the specifics? Because a few senators have talked about the process of going into a basement and not being able to bring in a staffer, a cell phone, or a notebook, and they can't talk about it with their constituents.
Yeah, it's not possible to get the specifics without these WikiLeaks releases or anything like that. I talked to a number of cleared advisors who are other individuals who are cleared to read whatever the U.S. Trade Representative gives them. Sometimes it's the text, sometimes it's summaries. And they're not allowed to tell me exactly what's in the agreement. So you play this game of pantomime where they talk in broad terms about things that might be in the agreement that they cannot confirm nor deny, but then they, you know, go on to describe, you know, something about them. The secrecy has definitely hurt the administration in terms of selling this agreement. Members of Congress do not like being treated like 12-year-olds. They don't like having their cell phones taken away, or the fact that their staffers who don't have security clearance can't read the document, even if they're experts in the particular field that the document describes. This has been a major misstep. All the way back in 2001, Robert Zoellick, who was then the U.S. Trade Representative, released the full text of the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas prior to the fast-track vote. This is not unprecedented that you would have an administration give the details before Congress had to go down and vote so that the public could weigh in. That's not how the Obama administration wanted to do things, and I think it's actually really damaged them.
And, David, I wanted to ask you about... David, I wanted to also ask you about Medicare cuts, because we just got an email from a listener, Karen, who says, please mention what the mainstream media ignores. The TAA, drafted by Republicans, cynically requires $700 to $950 million in cuts from Medicare to pay for it. Therefore, it's not just that Democrats are shooting workers in the foot by strategically choosing to reject the TAA. It, along with the TPP, is terrible policy. And David, you wrote about this.
Yeah, it's true that the Senate version of the bill and what the Senate passed did include this $700 million cut to Medicare by extending the sequester, which is what we all live under here, out another several months. This was something that Nancy Pelosi tried to use as a point to make a deal, saying you have to change this, and if you change this, maybe my caucus will go along. And in fact, the House did change it in an African trade preferences bill that was voted the day before the TAA last Thursday. They changed the offset from Medicare to, I believe, something that imposes more penalties on noncompliance for taxes. So that has been changed, but that wasn't really ever the complaint among the Democratic caucus. I mean, it was a complaint, but it was one of a piece. And the larger complaint was that this bill would not be good for American workers, and if there's leverage on the part of Democrats to stop it, they're going to take that and use it. So I think the Medicare thing is obvious, problematic. It's more problematic in that Medicare gets used as a cookie jar that whenever the Congress needs money, they can just extend sequestration out. The other problem is that why is trade adjustment assistance paid for? I mean, if all these benefits economically are supposed to come to the United States from trade, why can't they take a little money out of that to help workers who are displaced? It's almost as if they don't believe that there are these great economic benefits, and then you have to pay, get the rob from somebody else, some other kitty, to pay for the people who get left out in the cold once these trade deals come forward. So I think there are a number of problems with that, but that's the state of play on the Medicare issue. Turned out that wasn't the only problem that Democrats have.
And then, David, in a piece you wrote, you also say what really concerns you is a piece of the TPP which would affect the cost of prescription drugs.
Yes, absolutely. And Dean has talked about this.
Right, today. Dean. I'm sorry. Yeah, Dean, you wrote about that.
Yeah, well, there's several parts that would affect the cost of prescription drugs. So on the one hand, it allows evergreening of patents. So this means that and it is a common practice for companies after, as their patents are about to expire after 20 years, they do a slight variation and then get a whole new patent. So that could give them, in effect, 40 years of patent protection. It also requires countries, and this would be not the United States, because the United States is notoriously lax patent standards, but requires countries to have very lax patent standards, meaning almost anything could be patented. Someone famously patented a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in the United States about 2 decades. I mean, they did it to show that you could patent anything. I mean, they wrote up in technical language, but, you know, it was approved. So we're requiring other countries have the same sort of patent procedure. You could patent almost everything, so they'll pay much more for drugs. We also have an issue about how long people have to have data exclusivity. This is even stronger than patents, because what it means is that once a clinical trial has been done showing that a drug is safe and effective, no one else could use that data to bring a generic on the market. In principle, you can innovate around a patent. It's very difficult and questionable ethically to do a clinical trial when you already know a drug's safe and effective. So if you have a cancer drug, you know it's safe and effective. Are you going to give a placebo to people as you try to show that your generic is also safe and effective? And then the last part, the transparency part, is again something that was leaked by WikiLeaks. We know this because there was the intellectual property chapters were leaked by WikiLeaks, 2 versions of them. There's a section on transparency which requires Medicare, Medicaid, other government programs, this would be our trading partners as well, to have to give an explanation if they refuse to pay for a drug. So if you have, you know, Pfizer or whoever has their new drug that they're charging $50,000 a year for, and many of these new drugs do cost that much, I'm not pulling it out of the air, and the assessment of the healthcare agency, Medicare, say, is this is really no better than the generic that might be $10, and they say, you know, we're not going to pay for it. Well, they could dispute that, and they could take that to these investor state dispute settlement mechanisms, and who knows, maybe they'll win, maybe they won't, but that could jack up the price of drugs enormously if, you know, Medicare's required to pay, you know, $50,000 for a drug when a generic that's every bit as good is available for $10.
You also point out in your piece the hepatitis C drug Sovaldi. The patent protection version sells in the U.S. for $84,000, and the generic version sells in India for less than $1,000.
Yeah, and this is what we're seeing with these new drugs. They're charging. You have some cancer drugs. They're selling for over $100,000 per year for people's treatment. You're seeing huge prices like this, and almost invariably, these drugs are cheap to produce. So it's not that they're expensive to produce. The drug companies say they have research costs, which of course they do. But the point is, once the drug has been developed, you've already paid that. And, you know, one of the things that just drives me nuts is that people refer to this as a free trade agreement. Well, patent protection is protectionism. And if you raise the price of a drug 100-fold, as is roughly the case with Cevati, by giving a company a patent monopoly, that has the same impact on the market as if you impose a 10,000% tariff.
Wow.
And, you know, I have all these people, well, we like patents. I go, good for you. We're glad you like them. But it's protectionism, and we could use the exact same story about how bad protectionism to talk about your patents, because it applies. The market doesn't care if the price is high because of a tariff or because of a patent. It reacts the same way.
Dean, on that, to your point that this is really not a trade deal, Robert Kuttner said the same thing. He says this is really has never really been primarily a trade deal. The administration is marketing it as a trade deal, and for the most part, the press have bought the storyline.
Yeah, and again, this is one of these things that's just infuriating because, you know, everyone's taught who's been to, you know, taking a college economics course, you're supposed to like free trade. And, you know, Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, he was good enough to actually say this explicitly. He was giving a talk somewhere and someone asked him about some trade deal. I don't know which it was, but he said, I haven't read it. He goes, all I have to see is two words, free trade, and I support it. So that's the logic here. This is free trade. The Washington Post had an editorial today condemning everyone who opposed it because they don't support free trade. And, you know, the reality is most of these countries already have trade deals with the U.S. So they talk about this huge trading block. Well, guess what? We already have a trade deal with Mexico. We already have a trade deal with Canada. We already have a trade deal with Australia. Most of the countries in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we already have trade deals with. So the idea that there's going to be some big reduction in tariffs and a huge increase in trade doesn't make any sense. So it really is about setting up a regulatory structure, setting up stronger and longer patents and copyrights. That's what it's about. Trade is really peripheral to this.
Dean Baker is an economist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, and David Dayan is contributing writer for Salon. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. If you have any questions about the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we'd love to hear from you. Why do you think President Obama is pushing so hard for the TPP? Let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. One of the things that is very troubling is that the leadership of both major political parties seems to have this blind faith in free trade without any concern for the details. On this legislation called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, perhaps five components deal with trade, and all the rest of it deals with all sorts of other things. And there seems to be in the press reading about this legislation, there's very little information about all these other components, mm-hmm. like giving corporations the power to overrule environmental laws. And if a country enforces its environmental laws and it's going to cost future profits for some transnational corporation, they can then run off to the WTO or whoever and file an appeal. And then if you want to, you don't have to pay anything for ruining the environmental situation in a country. And then they have to be paid because their future profits are going to be placed in jeopardy. This, to me, is insidious. Why anybody would vote for this is amazing. And since Obama was a member of the Harvard Law Review, you think he's blind to these things or he sold out to corporate America. That's the only explanation I have.
Well, this is even somewhat worse than John suggested because it's not taking it to the WTO because that's at least government to government. So if an investor was unhappy under, you know, say, NAFTA, then they would have to run to the WTO and say, hey, you know, this violates WTO conditions, and, you know, the WTO would make a ruling. They'd have to get the government, U.S. government, to do that. I'm sorry. But in this case, what you have are these investor-state dispute settlement mechanisms. When I first heard about this, I thought it was crazy conspiracy stuff, but this is real. There's three-person panels. The investor bringing the suit gets to pick one person. the U.S. government gets to pick a person. And keep in mind, the U.S. government picks the person regardless of whether it's a federal law, state law, or, you know, a local law. It doesn't matter. The U.S. government picks it. I'm emphasizing that because, you know, we have President Obama in the White House. You may like him, may not. But he's not going to be there after 2017. So is it going to be Jeb Bush? It'd be Hillary Clinton? I don't know. That's who's going to be protecting, you know, the laws that come out of California or wherever else. Mm-hmm. And then they jointly agree on a third person. And this ruling is not subject to appeal. It's not even published. I think there's a three-year or five-year lag. We don't know the time period because they're negotiating that. It's not published. It's not subject to precedent. I mean, they could review other precedents. And that overrides whatever law. So if the state of California wants to have a stronger environmental regulation in terms of greenhouse gas emissions or, you know, emissions of some harmful substance, whatever it might be, and there's a company, it could even be a U.S. company, but they have a foreign subsidiary sue the state of California, then, you know, they say they can't override the U.S. law. Well, that's literally true. The California law would sit, but they might end up having to pay, you know, $300 million, $500 million a year to whoever's brought the suit.
And, David, what about other countries that are involved in these negotiations? I mean, there have been major protests in Australia, Japan, Canada, New Zealand, for example.
Yeah, other countries, I think other countries' medias seem to be disseminating a little more information than the U.S. media does, which is just sort of gives the banner of free trade and leaves it at that. So there have been protests, and you can see in the WikiLeaks releases that other countries are actually not in favor of various parts of the agreement. Australia has said they're not going to do investor-state dispute settlement whatsoever. They're already mired in a dispute over cigarette labeling with Philip Morris. Philip Morris has sued the country of Australia over that and is looking for profits. So they're not going to play in that game. The real issue here, or one of the issues here, is that workers who are in situations where the terms of agreements are violated or their rights are violated, and labor agreements or labor standards that are supposed to be in the agreement are violated, they can't go to a separate tribunal and pick the person who gets to adjudicate the dispute. They have to go to, unions have to go to their host government, and maybe their host government listens to them and maybe not,
right.
And then they go through a process at the WTO. There's no worker state dispute settlement.
You know,
this is only for corporations.
And this is really important when you look at Vietnam, because what's happening is so many people in China are standing up and saying, we are tired of being exploited, we want a living wage, and they're organizing. I mean, they're protesting regularly in China. Mm-hmm. So multinationals have their eye on Vietnam. And a few politicians have basically said, we cannot ask U.S. workers to compete with people in Vietnam making 50 cents an hour. And the conversation tends to stop there. But what about those people in Vietnam who right now are being paid by Nike, for example, to make shoes for the West, 50 cents an hour, mostly women?
Yeah, Vietnam has terrible labor standards. There's only one union in the entire country, and it's controlled by the Communist Party. Under the sort of rule of origin rules that are within TPP, theoretically, China could make most of a good and then ship it to Vietnam. They slap a label on it, and then it goes off to the United States without any tariff. Mm. So China can benefit from this agreement without being even a party to it. So it's not just the fact that Vietnam or Malaysia have these terrible labor standards and use child labor and use slave labor. In the case of Malaysia, Malaysia is seen by the State Department as one of the worst countries in the world for forced labor, and yet they are in this agreement. If this ever goes through, they're going to need to create a compromise to allow Malaysia to participate in the agreement, despite their horrible record on slave labor, which would be sort of the first compromise on slavery in the U.S. legislature since the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854. It was like the stuff we fought the Civil War over, and yet we're making an accommodation for Malaysia to get them into this agreement. So there's a host of issues with respect to labor standards. And again, there's no worker state dispute settlement. So these labor standards, even if they're put into the agreement, they are not rigorously enforced pretty much by anyone.
We have another question about the countries that are involved with the TPP. Michael writes in, if Singapore, for example, allowed some sort of chemical that the U.S. has banned or has strict rules on, if they find that law too troublesome, can they call for a vote on its fairness? And if that vote comes out in favor of Singapore, what happens to that regulation? Is it just pushed aside, or would the U.S. be punished in some way via trade sanctioning? Basically, what authority could an outside country with more lax standards have over U.S. products?
Well, it would be from the standpoint of an investor. So, you know, if someone had wanted to sell the product, you know, if there's a single company located in Singapore that wanted to sell the product in the United States, and again, you know, this point David's making, you know, the company could literally be anywhere. It could be a U.S. company, but it could be a subsidiary in Singapore, and they may produce the item in China or India, wherever it might be. So, you know, it's not a hard thing for them to be based in Singapore. So anyhow, so they could take this up in investor state dispute settlement tribunal, and you know, again, they get to appoint one of the three people. The U.S. government would appoint a second. They would jointly appoint a third, and they can't literally overturn the law. So if the U.S. has a law banning this, that law is allowed to stay in effect, but they could say, okay, but we have to pay, the United States has to pay X amount in terms of damages, because that's what this company would have made in profits had they been allowed to sell the product in the United States.
Yeah, I'll give you a perfect example, which is happening right now. The WTO very recently made a ruling on country of origin labeling for meat and produce. Mm. That was because Canada and Mexico filed a trade sanction with the WTO, saying that their meat wasn't allowed into the United States under NAFTA, and this is a problem because of the labeling. So the WTO found for Canada and Mexico, and just last Wednesday, 2 days before this trade vote, the U.S. House voted to repeal the country of origin labeling law in the United States because they knew that sanctions were forthcoming, and the only way to stop those sanctions from coming, which would have been debilitating on supermarkets and any meat producer or anything like that, the only way to stop it is to repeal the law. And so this idea that you can't change U.S. law through a trade deal is really misleading, because maybe you can't change it, but you can certainly compel the country involved through sanctions, monetary sanctions, to repeal it themselves.
Hmm. And Food and Water Watch says they're really concerned about the TPP being used to challenge U.S. food safety standards.
There's a real risk of that, you know, and again, it opens the door for it. And it's interesting, because I've talked with people in the Obama administration. They poo-poo this, and they go, oh, well, that's not going to happen. And that could be true. I mean, my view on this is, you know, they talk about the investor state dispute settlement mechanisms that David and I are both talking about here. And they say, no big deal, it's unlikely to happen. And you go, okay, but why do you have it? And the argument for these investor state dispute settlement mechanisms is that you have some countries, you know, no one would say this about the United States, no one would say it about Canada, Japan, most of the countries in the PAC, but you have some countries, you know, for example, Vietnam, they don't have a well-developed independent judiciary. So the argument is that we want to make investors feel comfortable when they invest in Vietnam, that they know the Vietnamese government won't expropriate them, treat them arbitrarily. So that's why we have to have this. So you're sort of left scratching your head. So you're saying that the United States, Canada, all these other countries have to set up this mechanism that overrides our judicial system so that General Electric and Boeing or whoever else could feel more comfortable in investing in Vietnam. I mean, that seems like a really bad trade-off.
Well, thank you for those emails. Let's go back to another call. Let's hear from Joe in San Francisco. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was wondering what would happen if somebody, a senator, actually spoke about what they read, and wonder why nobody's sort of called the president's bluff and spoke up about it.
David, do you want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, some senators have talked in very broad terms about it, whether it's Senator Elizabeth Warren or Senator Bernie Sanders. I believe what the caller is referring to is the speech and debate clause, the idea that a member of Congress can go on the floor and sort of be constitutionally protected if they speak even about classified information. I guess the rejoinder to that is good luck ever getting any kind of bill passed ever again, really. There are certain things indirectly that you could do to a member of Congress, Maybe it makes sense if the member of Congress is retiring or something. But it's a difficult proposition. And certainly, enough information has been able to get out, whether it's through WikiLeaks or through the sort of elliptical way in which members of Congress talk about this, to make the public understand that there are some concerns. And as Dean said at the top, the public is concerned and generally doesn't favor these kinds of trade deals because they've seen the history over 20 years of these modern free trade agreements, so-called free trade agreements, that end up costing American jobs.
And David, what about other trade agreements? The TPP is getting a lot of attention, but you recently wrote about the transatlantic trade and investment partnership between the U.S. and the EU, and then the 51-nation trade and services agreement. These have not gotten much attention at all.
Yeah, TPP is sort of getting all the attention because it's closer to being completed. But these other two agreements are actually larger in terms of the economic impact. I mean, the U.S. and the EU are the two largest entities economically in the world. And so putting them together in TTIP would have far-ranging consequences. And then the TISA, the Trade and Services Agreement, which would govern all sorts of services from healthcare to financial services to education to public services like the mail delivery or maritime delivery, involves 51 nations, the U.S., the EU, and 23 other countries, and is meant to be sort of a Trojan horse to govern how trade in services is done across the entire WTO, and that's 154 nations. So these are massive agreements that would make create these regulatory caps, harmonize "quote unquote" regulations among across borders, and basically, undermine the sovereignty of these countries by ensuring that they can't regulate their citizens in their public interest above a certain threshold. And so there's a host of very troubling pieces. WikiLeaks just released a number of documents related to the Trade and Services Agreement. Even though it's many years off, the issue is that fast track lasts for 6 years, no matter who's president. As Dean said, it could be Ted Cruz as president, it could be Scott Walker, it could be Hillary Clinton. We don't know. And yet, fast track would be in effect if it passes now for the next 6 years. So those priorities of that next president could be reflected in a new trade agreement.
David Diane is contributing writer for Salon, and Dean Baker is economist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thank you both for joining us, and thanks for sharing all of this information.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How is urban farming changing cities? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about urban agriculture. 80% of the U.S. population lives in cities, further from farms than ever, but more and more city dwellers are growing their own food. The film Growing Cities examines this trend from the Bay Area to Detroit. How are urban farms revitalizing communities and changing the way we eat? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.